This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. It's often said America is a country interested in the here and now, today and tomorrow. Yesterday is, well, so yesterday. Journalism professor Carolyn Kitch disagrees. She argues that we're obsessed with yesterday. She says the past permeates current journalism. Now, she'll also tell you that doesn't mean we don't misremember or forget. Carolyn Kitch is our guest in this portion of the program. She's the author of Pages from the Past, History and Memory in American Magazines. For this book, she looked at more than 60 magazines, including Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Ebony, Ladies Home Journal, the National Geographic. Kitch says the book is about how, in her words, cultural narratives are constructed and reconstructed over time in ways that draw on the past to make sense of the present and future. Here's something else she says in the book's introduction, quoting again, "It is from the media that we get many, perhaps most, of our notions about history as heritage." Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Carolyn Kitch is an associate professor of journalism at Temple University. In addition to Pages from the Past, she is the author of The Girl on the Magazine Cover, The Origins of Visual Stereotypes in American Mass Media. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Kitch, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
You know, as we're talking this afternoon, 2006 is just, what, a week old? Not even that? And so we've come through a couple of weeks now where news magazines and other news media have done what they call year-enders. Mm-hmm. They've looked back over the previous year. How long has the year-ender been around?
Time Magazine was, of our existing news weekly magazines, Time Magazine is the oldest one, and it was founded in 1923. And they began naming their Man of the Year, as it was initially called, in 1927. So it took only 4 years for that sort of device to be used at the end of the year to not only to name an important figure who stood for what it meant to be American, but also to sort of summarize whatever were perceived to be the major cultural issues, political issues of the previous year.
Yeah. The year-enders, the commemorative issues we see on newsstands, what is their power? Why are we drawn to them?
I think that we're drawn to them. Well, it's significant that this practice began, at least in the newsweeklies, with a man of the year, that personalization is a very big part of the appeal. And this is for, I think, basic reasons of human communication. It's not just a manipulative tactic of the news media. We grow up understanding the present and the past through stories, and they are stories that tend to feature certain kinds of characters who we sort of recognize, even though they're different people in the news narrative as it evolves over time. And so part of the appeal is the fact that most magazines, not just the newsweeklies, I mean also Sports Illustrated has Sportsman of the Year, and most magazines will, when they do any kind of recap, especially the bigger ones, decade summaries, whereas we saw 6 years ago, century summaries, we tend to understand our world in terms of people who both represent, sort of ironically, at the same time they represent the greatest of what we can achieve, and yet also are described as being typically very much like us.
Mm. Also, I think at some point in the book you make the point that these commemorative issues, the issues where we see a retelling of the past year's events or phenomena and what happened, can be, in a sense, a comfort to us because we go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yes.
I remember that.
Yes. When news events were, or when any collection of events, let's say the Sports Illustrated again comes to mind because it just had its 50th anniversary issue. And one of the chapters in the book looks specifically at magazine anniversary issues and the ways in which magazines about, ostensibly very different topics tell the story of the American past through those topics. And when you see the past as a story told over time, there is a sense of comfort to it because it makes sense. It's a way of making sense of, it's a way of suggesting that there's causality. You know, that it, when times are bad, then they become good again. When we face challenges, then there's an answer to the challenge. You can see that as disturbing in that we keep having the same problems over and over, or you can see it as comforting, sort of this central message that there's something in the American spirit which tells us that we will get through whatever crisis lies ahead. And in a narrative sense, stories about the past are always about the future as well.
Yeah. I would like to talk a little bit about the power of story, and I'm going to draw on something I read recently in a magazine, The New Yorker. It was a profile of a British writer, Philip Pullman, and he writes secular fantasy stories for kids. And in the piece, the author, Laura Miller, the reporter, she wrote that for Pullman, stories are the elemental particles of meaning without which we'd be less than fully human. And then she goes on to quote Pullman, and he says something very interesting. She quotes him from a speech that he gave, and he said, "We need stories so much that we're even willing to read bad books to get them, if the good books won't supply them. We all need stories, but children are more frank about it." And then this article in part is about secularism and theocracy, and Laura Miller goes on to say, what angers Pullman most about theocracy in the end is that it blinds people to the true purpose of narrative. Fundamentalists don't know how to read stories, including those in the Bible, metaphorically as if they were Lord Asriel's imaginary numbers. And that character, the Lord there, refers to a character, one of Pullman's characters. A couple of questions come up here. What do you think about Pullman's observations? And two, how good are we at looking at narratives critically and understanding them?
Gosh, that's a big set of questions. I think that the observation he made, he makes about people's natural need for stories, and I think that's quite perceptive whether or not we perceive that we need them, or we will admit that we need them. I think in journalism, you know, many journalists would say, "No, I don't. I report the news. I'm not thinking in terms of, creating a narrative that unfolds in a certain way, but rather that events are just out there and they happen to unfold in a certain way." And yet, we fundamentally understand the world through stories. I mean, psychologists have written about this. This is not just a cultural phenomenon of our own making, or this true in any time. I think it's also important to point out that this is not just a media phenomenon or a literary phenomenon, that we understand the world through stories. History textbooks, what we think of as careful historical research, the sort of textbooks that we read in high school and college, real history, which is, and historians often sort of look down upon historic or nostalgic media stories, but real history is told as stories as well, and are told as chronicles in which there is a causality, and there are triumphs and defeats, and there are heroes and there are villains. Sociologists have written that we need to have a sense of memory. In order to have a sense of collective memory, shared memory, in order to have a sense of shared social identity and a sense of our meaning in the world over time, and in order to have memory, we have to forget, because if we remembered everything, we would go crazy. And we have to put them into stories, whether they are they seem very personal to us as family stories, or we think of them as sort of national myths. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah. And again, you know, how good are we at looking at narratives critically?
I think that's a very good question. And it's one of the things that I've tried to step back and do in this book from a scholarly point of view. That said, it's almost impossible to do this because, I mean, one of my real beliefs about journalism, and I myself used to be a magazine editor, is that there's not a division between what people who create the media do and you know, what people who are reading media are doing in processing the content, because we all grow up in America. And I keep talking about America as opposed to other countries because that's the focus of this book, but it's true in other countries as well. We grow up within the same culture. It is a culture in which, from our earliest memories, we learn about the world through stories. And so in that sense, it's almost impossible to stand outside, to say, I'm now going to understand the world in some way that is not narrative. I think that's very difficult for anybody to do, whether they're an academic critic or a historian, or whether they're, you know, a general consumer of the media.
Hmm.
At the same time, I think that most of us are pretty aware of this. In a way, what I'm saying is, you know, most people are thinking, well, yes, this is obvious. We know what the appeal of good storytelling is, and we find it in all kinds of places, which is, you know, why we have very different kinds of media media products that become wildly popular and strike a chord in people.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Carolyn Kitch, professor of journalism at Temple University. She's the author of Pages from the Past, History and Memory in American Magazines. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on line 4 in Eureka, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. A very interesting conversation. I'd like to ask two questions, and I'll take the answer off the air, please.
Okay.
First, and I'll try to go slowly so the guests can understand, I was thinking about Toffler's book, Future Shock. For one of his theses seems to be that because of the overwhelming rate of change and maybe overpowering, his word, not mine, my word, not his, that people often retreat into a kind of nostalgia and maybe social conservatism in order to adjust. And secondly, when one brings up fundamentalism, evangelicalism, I realize it covers a very broad area and there are great differences, but it seems to me one of the reasons for its revival is that their biblical worldview, literalistic as it may be, gives them a kind of way to understand, and even maybe a worldview that explains the complexity of the present without digging too deep. Thank you very much.
You've brought up a couple of very interesting points, and I'm tempted to answer. And this something that's been very much on my mind lately, as well as on the minds of lots of people in the last 24 or 48 hours, and it's what's happened in West Virginia with these coal miners. And I'm sure that this is not the answer that the caller anticipated. But in terms of, let me go back to the first part of the question, which I think, if I understand it correctly, is in an age in which we feel overwhelmed by so much stuff going on, so much trauma, so much information, is it a sort of conservative move to retreat into nostalgia, which is, you know, not the real past, but sort of a pretty version of a lost past that perhaps never was? I think we do. I think it's not necessarily a phenomenon of now. If you are a media historian, as I am, you look at old magazines and newspapers from the turn of the 20th century, as well as magazines from the 1910s and 1920s, you'll see tons of nostalgia for sort of a lost rural past that most people never really had and yet like to think was the ideal of what they aspired to have. You know, the work of Norman Rockwell, which began appearing on the covers of the Saturday Evening Post in 1916, was precisely this vision, and magazines from the 1920s are full of discussion about, oh my goodness, we're overwhelmed by information, you know, we've lost sense of what it really means to be a real American, the same kind of, I guess you could call it conservative rhetoric that we think is a product of now. It tends to come up pretty regularly in journalism narratives across time whenever people perceive that they are at a moment of great change. And most people from various eras in the past, like us, thought themselves to be at the pinnacle of great change. So nostalgia is not a necessarily tied to conservative political rhetoric of any given period. I think it's a broader phenomenon. Should I stop and let you? Have I gone badly off?
No. Okay. But I want to go back to something that you said that's very interesting and that you touch on right from the get-go in your book, Pages from the Past, in regard to you mentioned the coal miners in West Virginia.
Right.
And in the book you say, you know, news coverage shows us how to behave publicly when tragedy strikes.
Yes.
That's an interesting idea. Talk about that.
Well, and we've seen that play out in a couple of ways. And this also is related to the caller's question about religious themes. I mean, there are certain ideas about what it means to be expressed through media, through mass media, including entertainment media, but also journalism, about what it means to be a good Christian in America, which has always been tied to sort of national mythology about what it means to be a good American. And at the center of those stories is a certain kind of character who is a man, who is a working-class man, who is stoic, who is physically very strong, who may not be very well-educated but works awfully hard, who puts the needs of his neighbors and his friends, often described as his brothers, the people he works with, ahead of his own for the sake of some greater set of values, for the sake of patriotism, for the sake of religion. And this is a common character of the most culturally resonant stories of the 19th and 20th century. It's the central character of all of the reminiscences we've seen of the Greatest Generation, the men who fought World War II. It was the central character of Saving Private Ryan. We saw it emerge again after September 11th in the character of the fireman. And then I was actually writing about that when the Kew Creek mine rescue happened in the summer of 2002. And I was so struck. I mean, my mother's family were anthracite miners, and I was so struck by how that story was covered. There have been mine accidents, much, much worse than that, for, you know, 150 years in this coverage and in this country, and nothing ever got the coverage that Kew Creek did. And it was because it happened within a year after September 11th, about 10 miles away from the crash site of Flight 93. And there was a rescue, but the story had to do with the salt of the earth, the person who was perceived to be the real American. And the part of the appeal of the narrative is, even if we are not that person, our parents were or our grandparents were. And the reassurance that there are still rural people who speak openly about their faith in God, who believe in miracles, who live simply, who stick together. A narrative template that strangely was applied to New Yorkers after September 11th is sort of a central American story that taps both into American mythology about this nostalgia for a better past. Really, I mean, coal mining is the most dangerous and dirtiest job. There's nothing romantic about it. But we saw that again in coverage of this, and people certainly they do know how to behave in front of media, but not just because of September 11th. I mean, as I write in the opening of my book, as I was finishing the book, Ronald Reagan died, and we had that whole week of sort of pageants, and people knew how to behave publicly, politically, because they remembered the Kennedy assassination, even if they didn't remember it. They had seen it on television. And so, but the story that was in place in this story in West Virginia was the miracle rescue, and the central plot being these are simple, basic people who believe in God, who believe in miracles, who stick together. Miners are a special breed. They know what to do. It was the story of Cube Creek, and so when the story went wrong, that was a profound shock that I think upset journalists. No one really knew how to proceed with the story. It is obviously a great personal tragedy for the families involved and a psychological shock. But I think that part of the narrative problem here is the almost embarrassment that if you tell a story like that, and if the moral of the story is we prayed and the miners believed, and that's why they survived, and then it turns out they didn't survive, then it sort of questions the central premise of the story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I heard yesterday a minister from that area say that all he could do was cry with those left behind and say, you know, it's okay to be angry with God. He'll understand. I think there are so many interesting threads of this story, and it'll be interesting as we look over the story and find and look at how was it that the news media got the story wrong there for a while, and you know what do we do with this story? Where do we place our anger? What do we do with our tears?
Ironically, I know it was sort of a general question, but I think the answer to the question of what went wrong is cell phones, and that in fact it was not. This is a, I don't want to say rare case, but I was watching CNN, and only CNN was covering it live, which really surprised me, because I was flipping it because I was also watching the Penn State game, which was going on at the same time, that supposedly the discovery that the men were alive was made around midnight. And I was flipping around the dials, and there was no other coverage except for CNN. And it was reported to CNN by a person, a family member, who had received a cell phone call from someone outside the mine. And so then the question is, what do you do with that? How do you tell the story? How do you not tell the story? How do you then say, well, this is a story of a mine accident, and we have to exercise caution and not report anything until we have, the word from official sources? In the way that we cover disasters now, the most authoritative source is the grieving family member. So a bigger question for journalists is, who is the source in a story like this? And it used to be perhaps that, we would wait for the mine president to tell us, and we wouldn't report anything until the mine president said something. But the story is emotional more than it is factual. And the story is the emotion of the jubilant family member. And if that's the story, then I think that's going to be covered.
Yeah. This also brings up a way of, looking at all the media that we have today, even magazines that we have, many of them are online. So they can report instantly. It used to be that a magazine, the deadline, was kind of out there. You had time.
Right.
How are magazines changing? How are they still the same? How do they allow us a little breathing room before we sit down and look over the story?
Oh, I think that's the periodicity of magazines and the longer lead time. Especially monthly magazines have a 2 or 3 month lead time. Weekly magazines are going to be a couple of days behind the news. But I think that's a great advantage to the magazine medium, because what magazines specialize in and have for more than a century is synthesis, explanation, speaking to and on behalf of us as Americans. That's one central difference between magazine journalism and most other kinds of journalism, the language, the likelihood that the reader will be addressed in a conversational way as you, that the editors and writers will use the words we and us in talking about the meaning of the news. This was part of when Henry Luce founded Time in 1923. This was part of the original Time mission statement, saying people have lots of information and they read the news. It's reported to them in the newspaper. We're going to tell them what it means. We're going to create stories, if you use that term, in order to make sense of the world so that people can understand what the news means. And I think that's what magazines do.
Yeah. So the editors you spoke with, the journalists you spoke with as you researched pages from the past, perhaps they spoke very openly and frankly about the influences of the past on current journalism and that feeling that we help people come together, that we create community.
Well, just to clarify, I didn't speak with... my book is a study of text. I did, in the course of doing research, I did end up talking to a number of editors because I was looking for background information and some magazines that I couldn't get except through the editors. And also, I mean, I've known editors.
You were an editor.
I was an editor at women's magazines. I was an articles editor at Good Housekeeping and at McCall's for 11 years in New York. And so, I mean, it's not that I don't have a sense of what their perspective is. And I think that, I mean, I know that I did talk with Dick Stolle, who is now retired but was the founding editor of People and the managing editor of Life and the person they sent to Dallas to get the Zapruder film in 1963. And he was the editor of, at the end of the century, Life published two huge books. Called Our Century in Pictures, and I forget what the other one was called, something like The American Century, and he edited them. And in it, you know, he wrote an editor's preface in which he talked about, you know, his anticipation of, you know, the relationship with the reader's memory, you know, would people feel that he had made the best choices and how difficult it was and what a sense of history journalists do have. They're perfectly, you know, aware that they have a role in telling history and explaining history to millions of Americans. Also, they write about it a lot, which is why there are so many quotes from editors in my book. They write it, almost any special issue, whether it is a special issue after a dramatic historic event like September 11th, or it's a 50th anniversary issue of the magazine, or it's the 25th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death. Any issue that claims to talk about the past will contain a letter from the editor addressed to the readers explaining why they chose to do what they chose to do and explaining what the editor thinks is the meaning of that part of the past. So there's a lot of sort of self-conscious, reflexive discussion within the text of the magazine itself.
Mm. Media historian, journalism professor Carolyn Kitch, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Pages from the Past, History and Memory in American Magazines. We're talking this afternoon about the role popular magazines play in the construction of historical narrative and memory. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There's a chapter in the book devoted to magazines directed toward an African-American readership and their role in developing a historical narrative for African-Americans and for the larger audience, all Americans, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And the role, you say, is often one of counter-memory.
Right.
And you say we might imagine history here as call and response.
Mm-hmm.
What does that involve? How does that work?
Well, these are not my terms or my ideas. I mean, counter-memory was something discussed by Michel Foucault, having to do with, you know, issues of power within storytelling. And who gets to tell the dominant tale? And it was American studies scholar George Lipsitz who talked about the role of call and response in African American music and his study of music throughout the 20th century that I was drawing on. But I mean, the notion of call and response, which, as Lipsitz argues, can be heard in black music of the 50s and the 60s, it comes from working in the fields. It comes from both. Sort of black Southern religious traditions, and then also the chant and the song of work songs, and was a form of communication and presumably, you know, subversion, self-expression in days of slavery. And historians for writing in African-American magazines, particularly Ebony, which is the longest surviving major African-American magazine, just celebrated its 60th anniversary, talk about this. In fact, Ebony is probably one of the best examples about what I was just mentioning, the open conversation of writers and editors about what they are doing and writing about history. And they see, they don't just imply, they say that history, for African Americans, history is a matter of obligation, that you must carry stories from the past into the future so that the past isn't forgotten, because the past is full of bad stories, as well as good stories, as well as stories of uplift and hope and achievement. But also that in keeping history, you are participating in a conversation with people of the past as well as people of the future, which I think is a beautiful notion. The idea that, which we tend to forget, that we are just, you know, one link, as Tolstoy said, in the great march of humanity. And so there is that sense of identity woven into how history is discussed in African-American magazines. The idea of counter-memory is either telling stories about the past that challenge what we think we know, that challenge conventional wisdom, say, about Abraham Lincoln, or that put new people into stories about the past where they haven't existed before, that put African-Americans or women into stories about great men, great white men, and to say that, yes, in fact, there were black people involved in these phenomena that we think of as totally white.
You know, going back to the coal mine story, and it used to be more likely that reporters would wait for the story from the mining officials. Mm-hmm. But now we are also interested in other folks involved in the story. Is this something we could refer to as counter stories?
Well, I think it's a challenge to, it shows how much the narrative form has come to dominate reporting and reporting practices. I don't think that this is necessarily a bad thing. In a sense, there always have been main characters in stories, and news has always been told in the form of the story. What shifted is who the main character is and what the nature of the story is. And who gets to sort of have authority as defining what the story is. And that used to be a combination of the reporter and official sources, who tended to be people speaking on behalf of the government or business. But the reason that story was covered the way it was, or was covered at all, is because it's not a story about a mine accident. It's not a business story about the mining industry. It's a story about a rural community united in fear and despair and grief. That's the story. In a way, it is, it's so insulting and probably distressing to people whose relatives have died in mine collapses and explosions and fires and flood, which was the case at Q Creek, you know, for decades, for centuries, and never were stories, because they were just a small business story. It's the emotion and the resonance with the larger cultural narratives, including September 11th, I think, which is still with us in so many ways, that story was covered at all.
Yeah. We got the story of September 11th largely, as you said earlier, through the vision of, or the story of the hero, the ordinary working man doing a very dangerous job. For us. And something that you say at some point in the book, and forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth here, but I think you also said this is how it's contributed to the narrative of the greatest generation, and it has given us a template for how we tell the story of American soldiers in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's right. although I think that the story, my the first part of the argument is that the reason that a particular story and a particular hero materialized out of the story of September 11th so quickly. By the way, I mean, the fireman hero wasn't in place right at the beginning. It took a while for that to become the main cultural narrative. It took maybe a week or two. But out of an event that really seemed inexplicable, and not the kind of event you could say, here's what the story is, my contention is that was a narrative that was with us all along and had been set in place, not so much during World War II itself, but beginning in the early 90s, when all of the World War II nostalgia, the World War II anniversary started happening. And for a while, we thought that would just go on from 1991 to 1995. And it's been back from 2001 and 2005. We celebrated all of the 60th anniversaries of all of the events of World War II. Part of this is because this generation is dying. Many have died. But also, as I mentioned in a chapter in the book that's about generational identity, the term the greatest generation didn't exist. I mean, this group of people were derogatively called in news magazines seniors. They were just thought as elderly people, you know, those sort of stubborn conservative parents that the baby boom rebelled against. They were not viewed this fondly and with this much reverence until, through journalism and popular culture, Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and then the film Saving Private Ryan, they became American heroes in the 1990s. At a time when there was great talk about, you know, a crisis of masculinity and where have all our heroes gone and why do we not, there was almost a strange nostalgia for the lack of a crisis in American society that would test the mettle of young men, you know, as World War II had, which showed how much time by the 90s, how much Vietnam had been forgotten. So the time was right, in other words. For this certain kind of mid-century American manhood, presumably lost, to come back in a working-class hero, whom we all feel we have some kind of connection with, even if we're not working-class.
Hmm. Let's take another phone call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I just have one question. I was wondering if you could discuss how, in a narrative, the author's opinion might have changed or how it's been constant throughout time. Just how the role of an opinion of the author comes through in a narrative.
I think it depends on the story. I think it depends on the medium. And one thing we tend to talk about journalism, and I'm guilty of this as well, as though it were one phenomenon. And in fact, you can see this just within the magazine business. There are lots of different types of magazines, lots of different voices, and you'll see that the writer is present in the story. The writer's personality, the writer's opinions are present in the story to a much greater extent in certain magazines than in others, and in certain other kinds of journalistic, perhaps more so in online journalism than in newspaper journalism. I'm not sure if that's true, but that's the presumption. So it varies. I think what's more of a factor is that is the institutional context, because when you work in a place, you work as a group of reporters with it for a particular news organization, you come to know, just by osmosis, how the story is told, what the voice of your magazine is. And I think what this caller is calling opinion plays out in the form of voice, perspective. How is it, is the story told in a tone of outrage? Is it told with great sympathy? Is it told, sort of somewhat sarcastically or distantly? You mentioned the New Yorker earlier, and once the New Yorker sent somebody to Western Pennsylvania to cover the Kew Creek community after the rescue, and the tone of this was unbelievable because it was an anthropological expedition. It was a very, I don't think the writer intended this, but it was a very odd, condescending description of what these little people in the hills were like. So I think that there certainly is a point of view that the writer brings to any storytelling, but that it's part of something bigger than himself or herself.
So point of view and how the story is constructed also would play a role here. Let's ask the caller if you'd like to follow up.
I'm more interested in like how the change of maybe the voice of what you're terming the voice, how has that changed throughout, you know, the American history and how the magazines have portrayed certain events, or and just sort of the change is sort of what I was wondering about. So thank you.
Okay.
Should I address that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right. I think there has been change, more notably in some sectors of the business than others. News magazines are a really good example. The voice of news magazines is now very, very different than it was in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. And it changed beginning in the 1970s and 80s, became more personal, became more opinionated, that you can clearly see a political point of view in many stories, and became sort of breezier and in some cases even flip. And that was a result of competition from television. And news magazines also, the content of news magazines has shifted so much toward an entertainment culture, towards celebrities, that's very much changed the tone of voice in which any story is reported. I studied news magazine coverage of September 11th. That was certainly very serious and reverent and careful in terms of trying to report facts responsibly, and yet it was very patriotic in a way that I don't think you would have seen in the 1950s or 60s, even though Henry Luce, who was still living then, was a politically very conservative. You wouldn't have seen 50 years ago the overt patriotism that was in apparent in the news magazines, supposedly the most, you know, sort of journalistic of all magazines, just after September 11th.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Homer Glen, line 4. Good afternoon. Do we have a caller there on line 4? No, okay. Well, we'll see if we can get that lined up correctly and give it another shot here in a minute. Going back to, you know, how a story like September 11th is still with us. We're still telling that story. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about the heroic template for telling a story and the coverage of American soldiers in Iraq. And so we had that very patriotic story going. And then along comes Abu Ghraib. How do you see that narrative shifting? Has it shifted?
I think that when the pictures from Abu Ghraib were published and published in the news magazines as well as newspapers, there was a potential. It was also at a point that was May of 2004. And that was also at a point where the war was still going on after having been declared over a year earlier in May of 2003. And there was the potential for the story of why we were in Iraq and what we were doing there to shift dramatically and to shift away from the template that's been used to cover Iraq. Is not so much September 11th, it is World War II. And in fact, in the very 60th anniversaries were going on, and those soldiers were compared directly to the men who had fought World War II. But what happened, fortuitously, for the story was that Ronald Reagan died within 2 or 3 weeks after the Abu Ghraib photos came out, and they exited the front page, and there was nothing but Reagan on the front page of. I looked at the. I have done a study of that as well. That's not in this book. I looked at all the top 10 circulation newspapers, all of the networks, NPR, and the major news magazines for at least a 10-day period, nothing but Reagan. NPR was the exception. But Reagan just, there were no other stories, except for Ray Charles, who interestingly died at the same, a couple days after Reagan. And when that went away, the Abu Ghraib photos were gone. And Reagan's story was a story about the greatest generation, and about sort of America's lost strength in the world.
We were back to mourning in America.
Yes.
Let's try and get our listener on line four in here, but we'll all have to be really quick. Line four, Homer Glenn, hi. Hi, I think he's on a cell phone, or he or she. Hello? No, well, we're going to have to wrap it up, I'm afraid, unfortunately. Anything you want to say in terms of summing up here?
Yes, I think I've been talking about magazines because that's what I studied. But I think that the importance of media in general, journalism in general, and fictional media in explaining the past to us is something that's culturally important, and that we, Americans as well as scholars, should take seriously and look at critically rather than just, you know, saying, oh, that's just media and nostalgia. I think that there's something bigger going on culturally in media that has very much to do with the past.
Mm, very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Journalism professor Carolyn Kitsch, she's a media historian. She is the author of Pages from the Past, History and Memory in American Magazines. The book is published by the University of North Carolina Press.